Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. So thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. Today's podcast was voted for by patrons and will be on Richard Speck. There is some question as to whether or not he would be a serial killer, but he is actually considered a mass murderer. So Richard Benjamin Speck was born on December 6th, 1941 in Kirkwood, Illinois. And since he was born in the 40s, and we've gone over the history of the early 40s many, many times, we will skip the history around the world for that time. I mean, World War II, coming out of the Great Depression, we know. Moving on for this one. So his father was Benjamin Franklin Speck, and his mother was Mary Margaret Carbaugh. Benjamin was born in 1894 in Illinois. Mary was born in 1903, also in Illinois, giving them a 9-year difference in age. Benjamin and Mary were married in 1922 when Benjamin was 28 years old. Mary was just 19. Richard was born into a rather large and very religious family. He was the 7th out of 8 children. Benjamin and Mary's first child was born the year they got married, which could be quite telling. Could Mary have been pregnant when they got married? It's not out of the realm of possibility, but in this day and age, no one really cares about that anymore, you know. But back then, that would have been quite scandalous. But I could only find the birth years of 5 of his siblings, but it would seem that every few years, his parents would have another child. But then there was a considerable gap, roughly 9 years, then Richard was born, followed quickly by the last child, who was a daughter. And it was said that Richard was very close with his father growing up, and no one would argue that Benjamin was a hard worker. Benjamin worked in farming and in the logging industry, but the family moved when the kids were still younger, and he then settled into a job as a packer in a factory or warehouse. Mary was a housewife, but her religious nature caused her to be a bit more still. She was what they called a teetotaler, meaning zero alcohol. You know, only the straight and narrow would do. So when Richard was 6 years old, his beloved 53-year-old father died from a heart attack. 3 years later, when Richard was 9 years old, Mary remarried a widower named Rudolf Lindbergh, whose wife had died before Richard was even born. She met Rudolph on a train ride to Chicago, of all things, as he was working as a traveling insurance salesman. They married, and she uprooted the children still living at home and moved them down to Dallas to begin their new life. It was said that Richard and the next younger sister stayed with one of their grown or married sisters to finish out at least the school year, but then shipped down to Dallas. Okay, so as far as stepdaddy Rudolph is concerned, he was the complete opposite of Benjamin, right? Benjamin was reportedly clean-cut. We know he was hardworking. Whereas Rudolph was a belligerent alcoholic who was verbally abusive and had a criminal record to boot. In fact, Rudolph was said to have a 25-year-long criminal record. And for whatever reason, sources said that Rudolph particularly enjoyed abusing Richard the most. He singled him out the most. He told Richard that he was worthless and stupid. So Richard started third grade in Santo, Texas, west of Fort Worth. Dallas and Fort Worth are like twins, right? Together cities, for those that don't know. But then another tragedy struck. Richard's older brother, or the oldest brother, died in a horrible car accident when the brother was only 23 years old. Richard was 11. And to say that the new family was poor is an understatement. And because of their poverty level, they were forced to move around fairly frequently and actually had, it was said, 10 different addresses in the next 12 years. At some point in his elementary years, it was discovered that Richard needed prescription eyeglasses, but he refused to wear them, and this led to him struggling in school. He was also described as a very anxious boy who could not even make himself speak up in class. As he neared puberty, Richard began drinking, no doubt emulating what he was seeing at home, right? He had to repeat the eighth grade because of his fear of people staring at him, kind of a little bit of a paranoia there, and his subsequent refusal to speak in class. He also had a very hard time making friends, as we could all assume. So at just 13 years old, this is in 1955, he was arrested for the very first time. It was for trespassing. He was already, by this point, taking pills, you know, taking drugs. Also, at some point in his early teens, he fell out of a tree and suffered a head injury. By the age of 15, Richard, whose skin did not, you know, fare well during the teenage years, and he had deep, obvious acne scars. He was also basically getting drunk nearly every day, and now he was just collecting misdemeanors left and right, just like anything that you can imagine, you know, he was getting busted for. He was well known to the authorities, and again, he was quite recognizable, you know, visually. His mother was apparently begging him to continue his education, and for her, he did manage to go to school on occasion. Richard went from feeling so very awkward around his peers, and always girls, to wanting the girls' attention. But it was said that if they did approach him, chat him up, if you will, he would get really red in the face and walk away, shy and horrified. By the time he started high school, he was failing every class. It would seem he would have to repeat his freshman year, and he was having none of that. So at 16 years old, he quit school. He was done. After, he maintained his rather strict regimen of petty theft and arrests and misdemeanors, you know. And this is as good a place as any to pause and reflect on what we know. Okay, so we will start with the obvious. He was born into this large family, number 7 out of 8. And the sibling before him, or, you know, before him and then himself, there were a number of years. His mother was 38 when she had him, his father 47. Now, there's nothing wrong with having children later, okay? It has plenty of benefits. I assume, I'm sure they're awesome. But she had already had 6, is what I'm trying to say. So how much attention was she actually able to give young Richard? Okay, so according to BigThink.com, quote, over the past few decades, scientific research has shown that children in larger families perform worse in school, score lower on cognitive tests, and attain fewer years of education than kids in smaller families. Researchers theorize that additional children stretch parental resources thin, leaving parents with less time, less energy, and less money to devote to their kids' development. A study was done by Professor Wei Xin Yu, a social demographer and vice chair of the sociology department at UCLA. It's a mouthful for me. And Hope Zhu Yan, a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of Maryland, tracked the children of all 6,283 women enrolled in the Bureau of Labor Statistics NLSY79 study. Whew. Over 30 years, these kids were regularly given a standardized vocabulary test to track their cognitive development. Mothers were also asked to periodically assess their children's behavior with age-appropriate surveys. Researchers particularly watched for antisocial, anxious, hyperactive, dependent, and antagonistic behaviors. Tallying the results, Yu and Yan confirmed the results of prior studies. The larger the family, the lower the kids' average cognitive scores. Later-born siblings scored worse at the same age than did their older siblings, suggesting that parents allocate less time to their development as time and money grow strained with extra children. The researchers also found that older siblings' cognitive scores deteriorate as they gain siblings. So as a bit of a sidebar, I just want to make sure that you don't think I'm saying that the babies and the later born children are all going to have something less than about them, okay? I'm not saying that at all, because there are factors such as, you know, socioeconomic, blah, blah, blah. You know what I'm saying? There's kids that just have a lot more privilege than others, and that changes things a bit. When money is not an issue, so on and so forth, that changes things a bit. So it's interesting nonetheless. So then Richard's father, whom he was quite close to, died suddenly from a heart attack. Now, this particular part of his history is intimately familiar to me. So I understand the pain of that loss that is nearly unbearable. I do. According to Psychology Today, early parental loss is associated with negative outcomes, including anxiety, depression, prolonged grief reactions, negative effects of sense of self, increased risk for suicide, substance abuse, and eating problems, difficulty with executive function, reduced quality of life, and changes to how survivors approach adult relationships. That is some heavy, heavy information, guys. So, the Pitt Department of Psychiatry researchers recently completed a 7-year prospective examination of pediatric grief following parental death, the longest and most detailed study to date. They found that the loss of a parent had an early and persistent negative impact on the academic and social functioning of the child that was in part due to the onset of depression within the first 2 years after the parent's death. The results were published in the American Journal for Psychiatry. Quote, we found that kids who have lost a parent are more than twice as likely than non-bereaved kids to show impairments in functioning at school and at home even 7 years later. Importantly, this finding held up even when we adjusted for risk factors such as a pre-existing psychiatric disorder in the child or parent, said the study's co-senior author, David Brent, MD, endowed chair in suicide studies and professor of psychiatry, pediatrics, so on and so on. So children who were less than 12 years old when their parent died were more likely to have depression than those who lost a parent in adolescence. Grieving children also had higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than non-bereaved children at all time points. So losing his father would have been utterly devastating. And then his mother remarried and the stepfather was, in summation, me trying to be polite, not good at all. Rudolph the stepfather was a mean drunk. He was very verbally abusive, and most sources said he was also somewhat physically abusive. And he singled Richard out specifically as his most favorite target. The National Library of Medicine, National Center for Biotechnology, who hashtag should be sponsoring me at this point, stated that the association between childhood abuse and adverse adult health outcomes is well established. Childhood abuse has been associated with a plethora of psychological and somatic symptoms, as well as psychiatric and medical diagnoses, including depression, anxiety disorders, eating disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic pain syndromes, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and even irritable bowel. Okay, so compared with non-abused adults, those who experienced childhood abuse are more likely to engage in high-risk health behaviors, including smoking, alcohol and drug use, and unsafe sex, to report an overall lower health status and to use more health services. Interestingly, among patients with depression, irritable bowel, chronic pain, and substance abuse, prevalence of reported childhood physical or sexual abuse runs as high as 70%. 70%. Childhood abuse is positively related to adult depression, aggression, hostility, anger, fear, anxiety disorders, and personality disorders. Many of these outwardly displaying behaviors are present in adult Richard, nearly all of them. And then we have the issue with his biological father being good to him and Richard having this highly positive relationship with him, to him dying and him being forced to be uprooted from the area he was at least growing up in, to move to a wholly unfamiliar area with a stepfather that was a dick. And let's not forget the untimely passing of one of his older brothers that he adored. That's a lot of scar tissue, you know? And this really shouldn't come as a surprise, but, you know, young people who persistently abuse substances often experience an array of problems, including academic difficulties, health-related problems, including mental health, poor peer relationships, and involvement with the juvenile justice system. Involvement. We'll put those in air quotes. I mean, this goes without saying, and Richard was staying drunk and popping pills and so on, starting just before puberty. We know this is true. When it came to shenanigans, Richard stood on business, as the kids say these days. I know, I'm trying to keep up. And we know for certain that he suffered a head injury in his youth, and many sources stated he suffered a few head injuries in his youth. But I had a hard time finding concrete sources as to when or how bad, you know, whatever. Regardless, we in this community are well aware what head injuries can do. It is also well known that he suffered with horrific and deeply scarring acne as a teen. Most sources stated it was from being incredibly poor, an alleged flea infestation in the homes, poor hygiene, and so on. Obviously, some of this would have to be genetic. But he was already quite anxious and isolating as a child, and as he was going through puberty, the skin issue would have contributed to the anxiety and the awkwardness towards his peers, and most definitely, girls. It was said that he was quite scrappy, and he fought often in his youth. He was very angry. He had very low self-esteem, believing the horrible things his stepfather told him about himself, that he was worthless, etc. The accumulation of all of this, and it is no wonder that he would later lash out. It is not an excuse. It can be part of the reason. There's a difference. In his early years, after Rudolph came into the picture, he was plagued with anxiety and a bit of paranoia. But I'll get into kind of more of the psychology stuff at the end, because I struggled with this. So we're going to get back into the story. So after quitting high school, right, it would seem that Richard actually settled just a bit a bit and got a job at a 7-Up bottling factory. And in 1961, and at 20 years old, he met 15-year-old Shirley Malone at the Texas State Fair. She was pregnant within 3 weeks, as they say. The couple then quickly married in 1962, and Shirley moved into the house with Richard, his sister, and mother, as by this point his horrid stepfather was out of the picture, having moved to California. Good riddance. So Richard's daughter, Robbie, was born while Richard was actually in jail for, quote, disturbing the peace after a drunken night out. As far as Robbie goes, she passed away a few years ago herself. Rest her soul. But once he was released, he robbed a grocery store, cashed a co-worker's check, and was arrested and convicted of burglary and forgery. He served nearly a year and a half. He got a tattoo, Born to Raise Hell, and was arrested a total of 42 times by the time he was 24 years old. In January of 1965, Richard Speck attacked a woman, threatening her with a supposedly 17-inch knife while she was in the parking lot of her apartment. He ran when she screamed. The police arrested him like a few blocks away. He was convicted of aggravated assault and was given a 16-month sentence to run concurrently with a parole violation sentence and returned to prison in Huntsville. However, he was released quickly due to an error. What error that is, in the time I give myself to research, could not find it. Dug and dug, have no idea what the error was, but there was an error. He was released July 2nd, 1965. But after he was released, Richard would go on to work for 3 months as a driver for the Patterson Meat Company. And although he had 6 accidents in the company's truck, he was actually only fired for failing to show up to work, which I find fascinating. So as far as his wife, Shirley, well, she later said that she was absolutely terrified of him. She later said that Richard would often sexually assault her at knife point and demanded sex 4 to 5 times a day from her. His probation officer once said, and I quote, "When Speck is drinking, he will fight or threaten anybody as long as he has a knife or gun. When he's sober or unarmed, he couldn't face down a mouse," end quote. And I think that statement really is pretty telling. Liquid courage is what that is called. Later that year, his mother influenced him, I say influenced in air quotes as well, into moving in with a 29-year-old divorced woman. He was 24 at this time. This woman was allegedly, apparently, an ex-professional wrestler, of all things, and now a bartender at his favorite bar, Jenny's Lounge, to babysit her 3 children. And if she were bartending, and that was his favorite bar, she had to have known that he was a habitual criminal at this point, so why she would trust him with her kids is beyond me, quite honestly. In March of 1966, it is said that he bought a used car, then used it to drive over and rob a grocery store to the following evening, ultimately stealing 70 cartons of cigarettes, which he then sold out of the trunk of his new to-him car in the grocery store's parking lot. It is the full audacity for me. The police traced the car, which he had at this point abandoned, and issued a warrant for his arrest for burglary. Also by this year, his marriage to Shirley was over. He then uprooted himself and moved up to Chicago and in with one of his sisters, mostly fleeing persecution for a laundry list of offenses he was suspected of back home. His ever-accumulating rap sheet, if you will, but once up there, he did kind of work as an offshore fisherman, but spent all of his free time and his money in local dive bars. He rented rooms in less than ideal, sketchy motels, but would eventually have to go back to his sister's. So at this point, just in his mid-20s, mind you, Richard was tall, lean, with, again, this, you know, the skin situation, and people described him as not very attractive. That's not my judgment. That's what people said. He was an alcoholic, to be sure, by this point, a drug addict, and had a violent streak in him that was just waiting to explode. His brother Howard found a job for him with a local carpenter, but when Richard found out that his ex-wife remarried someone 2 days after the divorce was finalized, he was angry. He reportedly threatened a man in a tavern restroom with his knife. In April of 1966, this is the year, 65-year-old Mrs. Virgil Harris returned home at 1 a.m. to find a burglar in her house with a knife. She described him as a 6-foot-tall white man who was, quote, very polite and spoke very softly with a southern drawl. The man blindfolded her, tied her up, assaulted her, ransacked her house, and stole the $2.50 she had earned babysitting that evening. Ugh. Sources said that a week later, 32-year-old Mary Kay Pierce was last seen leaving the tavern she worked at 12:45 a.m. She was reported missing 4 days later, her body found that day in an empty hog pen behind the tavern. She had died from a blow to her abdomen that ruptured her liver. These are believed to be Richard's work. Richard had helped build that pig pen, so of course the police questioned him about Pierce's death. They asked him to stay in town for further questioning, but when the police showed up at the hotel Speck had been staying at, well, they found out that he had left just a few hours earlier, carrying his suitcases and saying he was just going to go to the laundromat. Oh yeah, the old laundromat. He, of course, just skipped town. A search of his room turned up a radio and costume jewelry Mrs. Virgil Harris had reported missing from her house, as well as items reported missing in 2 other local burglaries in the past month. He moved back in with his sister in Chicago, and his brother-in-law took him down to apply for a job with the U.S. Coast Guard, where he had to be fingerprinted and photographed. He got the job, but during his first voyage, he got appendicitis and had to be helicoptered to the hospital, if you will. Once well, he went back out on the ship, he got drunk and brawled, and was taken ashore. In July of 1966, Richard's sister gave him $25 and dropped him off at a, quote, hiring hall to stay the night and await another job out on a boat. He walked a mile down the road to a motel. He checked in there instead. He then spent the rest of his day drinking heavily, attacking a 53-year-old woman at knife point that he had also been drinking with at the same bar. He forced her into his motel room. He assaulted her and stole a gun that she had had. He then dressed entirely in black, got something to eat apparently, went back to the bar, and he drank some more. At 11 p.m. on July 13th, 1966, after leaving the bar and walking a little over a mile, he stepped up to a townhouse in Chicago's Jeffrey Manor neighborhood. This townhouse was a dormitory for girls in nursing school. The girls staying there were working at the South Chicago Community Hospital. He walked in through a screen door. Once inside the house, Richard rounded up the frightened nurses who were inside. Holding a gun in one hand and a knife in the other, he reassured them that he was only there for their money. He herded them all into the bedroom, where he ripped up a bedsheet into strips and bound their wrists. He then took hours as he began to lead them out of the bedroom, one at a time, into other parts of the house, to kill them. One source stated that there were intervals of between 20 to 30 minute intervals in between each murder. Kind of hard to blame that one on being drunk and on drugs for hours. Each girl was strangled and stabbed multiple times. He stabbed, cut, and slashed his way all through but two One girl managed to get under a bed. She scooted her little self back against that back wall where Richard didn't see her. He was busy. She then had to listen to him, R-word, the last girl brutally, and then strangle her to death. The girl under the bed heard Richard Speck walk out of the room, but she was paralyzed with fear to move. She stayed under the bed against the wall for hours until the next morning. Still terrified, she took a chance. She crawled out from under the bed and slipped through a window. She then sat there sobbing until help arrived. A couple of sources said she screamed the whole time until help arrived. So she, the lone survivor of the encounter, later said, quote, "The American girls told us we more or less had to trust him. Maybe if we were calm and quiet, he will be too. He has been talking to all of us and he seems calm enough, and that's a good sign." How very wrong they were. Richard rented a rundown room and squatted because with his unique tall, you know, thin physique and the southern accent and the skin thing and whatever, people knew exactly who he was. Once he realized the police were looking for him, he tried to unalive himself by slitting his wrists. And it was while at the hospital getting treated for his wounds that he was arrested. So, some sources said this. A total of 5 psychiatrists were appointed to evaluate him. They all said he was sane during the crimes and was competent to stand trial. He was diagnosed with anxiety, depression, obsessive-compulsive traits, and a, quote, Madonna whore attitude towards women, which, if you don't know what that is, if you would like for me to cover it in, like, a true crime science episode, then leave me a comment or DM me or whatever and let me know. If I say something in one of these and you want to hear about it, you let me know. During his trial, which began on April 3rd, 1967, he claimed to have no recollection of the murders, something that did not bother the prosecution, as they already had an eyewitness ready to identify him. So he eventually confessed and later said that, though he had been high that night, he could have easily murdered if he were sober. The trial was a national sensation. It was one of the first times in the 20th century American history that someone had killed so many people at random. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to death. Though the laws changed and then, you know, obviously they just gave him life. So what was prison like for Richard? This is the part that the ones who know were waiting for. I see you. I know what you're doing. Well, though he was still basically a loner in prison for the most part, he did get caught with drugs and alcohol, and the warden even said that he was a, quote, big nothing doing time. Then some tapes later surfaced from the Stateville Correctional Center, and the media got a hold of it. On the tape, it shows Richard performing, you know, oral sex on other inmates, he himself walking around in silk panties and also doing cocaine. Another thing they noticed was that he now had breasts, supposedly from taking hormone treatments that he was somehow getting in prison. Whoever was filming asked Richard if he had killed those women, and he confessed that he had, stating, quote, "It just wasn't their night." He said he felt nothing the night of the murders. Richard Speck died in December of 1991, one single day before his 50th birthday. And if you've seen photos of him, you'll understand my shock, because he looked far, far older than 49. He was cremated, his ashes were given to his sister, the younger one, I assume, and she scattered the ashes. Now, some of you know about this, but I'm betting quite a number of you actually don't. There was some question as to Richard possibly having the XYY chromosome. To super simplify it, because there is a whole lot more to it, Again, if you want a true crime science episode on this, drop me a comment and let me know. Boys with XYY syndrome may have some or all of these physical symptoms to some degree. Here we go. Taller than average height. Low muscle tone or muscle weakness. Very curved pinky finger. And widely spaced eyes. Some boys also may have delayed development of their social, language, and learning skills. They also can have problems with reading and understanding math and may have mild delays in coordination. Some boys with XYY syndrome may develop behavioral problems such as ADHD, autism, temper tantrums, impulsivity, or defiant behavior. These problems might ease as they get older and reach adulthood. Otherwise, treatment can help manage these issues. A small number of boys may have increased testicular size for their age or have an increased risk for asthma and seizures. And I'll save you the question, Richard did not have this. He was tested. He's just a regular old XY. So his case is a bit different. I find it hard to think in terms of him having conduct disorder in his youth. You know, it's if you look at it surface level, people might slap that on it, right? But it seems to me at least that it was just lashing out due to the terrible abuse that he was suffering at home. I feel like there can be a difference. I don't know quite how to word it. I hope you know what I mean. He was quite anxious and he was a bit paranoid in his youth as well. A lot of sources seem to have him diagnosed with quite varying issues, which was also really surprising. I saw sexual psychopath. I saw sociopath with comorbid paranoid personality disorder, which is the one I would kind of lean toward. There were a couple of others, but I'm kind of leaning toward that one. And that is the case. What do you think, guys? He suffered quite a bit in his youth. We have some head trauma, physical, emotional abuse, loss of a parent, all of the things, right? But for whatever reason, there's just a part of me that just can't just like, he killed those women just one right after the other. One right after the other. You know, I'm not saying serial killers are better. They're all screwed, right? They're all screwed up. We get it. But, you know, you go and you kill one person and it's over and you get away from it. And that's just one. He went back for each one. This lasted for hours, guys. What even is that? So he's just kind of, this one gives me the ick. He's not quite like Albert Fish. But he definitely gives me the ick. So let me know what you guys think about this one. And as always, thank you so much for listening, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you keep choosing me, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, guys. Gosh, have a good day.
Anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time. And then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.